Roger Williams University is hosting a crisis management seminar on May 3rd at their Providence campus. Crises, whether a natural disaster, cyber attack, or financial instability, can have severe repercussions if not handled properly. This is where crisis management plays a pivotal role. Join Roger Williams MBA students and expert speakers to learn how to prepare for the unexpected. The program is totally free and open to the public. You can register online at rwu.edu/events/crisis-management-symposium.
This is the Bartholomew Town Podcast.
Hi, everyone. Welcome in to another edition of the Bartholomew Town Podcast. I'm your host, Bill Bartholomew. On this episode, we welcome back the one and only Jim Hummel of the Hummel Report. Mr. Jim Hummel, a living legend here in Rhode Island media. You watch his investigative reports at hummelreport.org. You read him in the Providence Journal. You hear him from time to time on WPRO. And of course, you watch him every Friday night as the host of A Lively Experiment, someone I am very happy to consider a friend and a mentor, back on the B-Town Pod. And man, was there a lot to get to here on this episode. We talk about his latest investigations, covering the governor and all that's going on with COVID-19, and what it's been like for him as a media personality operating here in these socially distant times. Look, a lot of the studios are closed. WPRO studios closed. Rhode Island PBS, the studios closed. So a lot of adaptation, for instance, A Lively Experiment is now being hosted via Zoom. So, man, interesting times, and who knows where this is all going, but there's one thing that's for sure. B-Town will be there for you every Tuesday and Friday with brand new podcast episodes and, of course, our live streams and on-location reporting, and I've got a new content partner I'm going to announce doing something brand new here in Bartholomew Town. Stand by for that. And by the way, if you want to support the Bartholomew Town Podcast, you can do so very simply by leaving a rating wherever you're listening right now, whether that's on Apple, Spotify, whatever app you listen to podcasts on. Just click the stars that you deem appropriate for this here program, and you'll be helping the cause. Okay, without further ado, let's get to it. Jim Hummel of the Hummel Report here on B-Town.
All right, you ready to go?
Let's do it. Hummel in the house. Here we are. We've got the UNC polo on. Governor, by the way, what a good memory. The governor
knew. Yeah, she's smart.
She's smart. Yeah, there's no other way to say it. But for the audience, she addressed a question after Jim had interrogated her for 15 minutes at the press conference last week or whatever it was. She had referenced, well, if you want to bring your kids back to school in North Carolina, of course, your twins went to North Carolina. They've now since graduated. But yeah, she's a smart cookie.
That's the mark of a good politician, don't you think?
I would say so. Yeah. Well, it's amazing that similarly, Sheldon Whitehouse, when he came for a podcast, I don't know, 2 years ago here at our loft, you know, he remembered every detail about my wife, Gabriella, that she was at RISD, that she had, you know, this, that, and the other. And that was going at least a year after we had encountered him previously when we were performing at an event of his. So there's some skill that they have that I certainly don't when it comes to just logging details of people. Or maybe he has a book that someone writes something down in and he references.
But you know, it also goes to the retail politics. And I use the example of years ago when Whitehouse was running for Senate against Link Chafee. Yep. Back whenever that was, 2006.
Yes.
I ran into him at Sports Authority in Seekonk. That's how far back it goes. And, you know, I covered him. I've known Sheldon for many, many years, going back to his first run for Attorney General. And I said, hey, will you want to come on 6 News on the Record? I was doing the Sunday show back then. He says, yeah, absolutely. Call my people. He had these out-of-town clowns running his campaign who viewed the media as these guys came from Chicago and New York and big markets where they insulated the candidates. And so his thought was, hey, yeah, sure, I'll come on. When I talked to his campaign people, this was in February, I said, hey, when can I get Sheldon on? They said, how about the end of May? And I burst out laughing. I thought they were kidding.
Right.
Turns out they were trying. And I said, what more important thing do you have to do in the next? I mean, what are you going to the Burl Senior Citizen Center next week? You're going to have a half an hour on TV, unadulterated, me and Sheldon. And they didn't want that. They thought that was bad. So what they don't understand in Rhode Island is, and the governor talks about this, people running into her in the supermarket and telling her, hey, you know. So I think people expect that retail politics that you just don't get in the larger states, where the governor knows that your kid goes to school in North Carolina, right?
Yeah, no question about it. It's actually one of the best things about Rhode Island. In fact, Paul McGonigal, do you remember from Channel 10?
Oh, yeah. And then he went to Fox 25, right?
Absolutely. And now he's in D.C. I wrote to him on LinkedIn or something, and I said, you know, hey, this is a year ago. Hey, I watched you when I was growing up as a kid. You know, I'd love to either chat or maybe have you on the show or whatever. And we connected briefly just by text or whatever, or by LinkedIn message. But he said Rhode Island was by far the most fun part of my career. And it's exactly for that. It's because your stories are so interconnected to the community at large, you know, covering Boston, covering DC, you never get that sense of you're really hitting home because you bump into people in the grocery store on a regular basis. So that's fascinating. So
my good friend, Cheryl Stolberg, who works for the New York Times, she was with the LA Times. She's a superstar. She covered the White House during the Bush and Obama year. She's now the national science correspondent. So she's known Anthony Fauci for like 25 years. She told me when she was here in the mid to late 80s. She went to the Los Angeles Times, you know, big time Los Angeles Times. She said, when the Providence Journal was in its heyday, when we were together, when a story hit in the journal, because Rhode Island is the city state, right? Everybody's in everybody's business. She said, I could do some huge story out of Sacramento. Nobody in LA is paying attention to that. But when you're in Rhode Island, when a big story hits, the entire state gets consumed by it. And as you know, Bill, now, and this is long before what you're doing in social media, then it gets picked up on talk radio. Then it gets picked up on Twitter. Then it gets picked up everywhere else. And we're kind of this one big kitchen table in Rhode Island, which is what makes it so fun to be in this market.
Unquestionable. It's a specific thing. And just even explaining that to people that friends of mine that are in Brooklyn or in one particular person who has a very successful independent website out of called Bushwick Daily out of Brooklyn, that it's got good reach. It hits, you know, that neighborhood, that market pretty well, but you're confined to that neighborhood. You know, he can't go and cover a story in South Brooklyn or in the Bronx. No one really cares. Even though it's a city where everyone's interconnected, it's not like Rhode Island where we care what goes on in Tiverton. If, you know, Justin Katz says something at a Tiverton city town council meeting, people in Westerly care about it. They know who he is and they react to it. So,
right. Park Slope and Gowanus and Williamsburg might as well be different countries, right?
Absolutely. Exactly. All right. Well, let's get into some of your recent pieces.
That was a long prelude, huh? That was the warm up show.
Exactly. Here we are. We'll see you guys next week here. You
know? Exactly.
First of all, the dentist. I went to the dentist on last Thursday. Your piece in your Hummel Report piece that ran in the Providence Journal, detailing the protocol that dentists are under, the amount of PPE they're wearing. I showed up first. They got a tent set up. They check your temperature. They get you through that. Then you wait around outside. You get called in. There's a security guard waiting for you as well, kind of blockading the door. I mean, this is
like you're going to rush the door to get in to get your teeth drilled, right?
Exactly. I mean,
let's go.
Like this guy must be watching every Netflix series in the world, you know, but yeah, quite a protocol. And it just speaks to what other industries are going to shift, what other dynamics that we're used to from a medical or basic services standpoint are going to be completely different after COVID, either because of the protocol or because of the financial dynamics that right now you have dentists who are saying, look, it's just because of all these, cleaning preparations that we have to go through and the amount of money we have to pour into just getting the place serviceable, it's not worth it to stay open.
Right. And so it that either makes you feel very reassured or it scares the hell out of you. Because when you go in and you see everybody in the hazmat suits, I think the one thing that I took away from the story, and just for the people who didn't see the story, the reason I had done it was I got an email from a woman, and her name stood out because it's Melanie Dufour-Pilney. I mean, who forgets that name, right? And I'm thinking, how do I know that name? Turns out, she opened a practice in Hope Valley in 1985. And as a young reporter in the Westerly Bureau for the Journal, I covered the opening. And so she said, wow, you got a great memory. I said, I can't remember what I had for lunch yesterday, but I remember that you opened this practice. Yeah. And her concern at that point was PPE, but she kind of set the table for where that story was going to go. And I was just talking to somebody about this the other day. What's very comforting to me is the American Dental Association, which surveys thousands of dentists across the country, they have not recorded, I'm sure it's happened, but they have not recorded one patient to provider or provider to patient case of coronavirus. So it really shows you, I don't know if you remember do you remember you took driver's ed in Rhode Island, right? So sure. By the time they got around to you, did they show you that film where like body parts are all over the place and you never want to drive, right? It scares the hell out of you, right?
Right, yep.
So the equivalent in dentistry is there's a YouTube, and you can go to it right now. Just put in if saliva was red. And look at look at what a dentist's face when, you know, the drill and the cleaning. And if you have more major stuff like a root canal, all of that stuff, if the saliva was red, man, it's everywhere. So this is what they're facing going back. So long story short is I was happy to be able to do the story. You and I sit at these press conferences and we hear all these endless questions about testing and the back and forth on the nursing homes and all this. My goal, and it has been since we founded the Hummel Report 11 years ago, is when most of the media is going this way, we want to go over here. And we want to fill the gap of stories that people aren't doing. The high school mass graduation story, the small business one that we just did last week about the governor, that, you know, and Lieutenant Governor Dan McKee, who has basically been relegated to the sidelines. So those are, and you know, this isn't a criticism on the rest of the media, but so many of them have to follow day to day to day what they're doing. I have a little chance to sit back and do some other stuff. And I think we filled that gap nicely. And we got an amazing response on that dentist story because everybody across the state is thinking, hey, when am I going to go in for a cleaning? Or what if I have a root canal? You know, and you know, dental work is something you can't really put off for very long.
Absolutely. No, it was an important story, and that just goes to show you know, why independent, or at least, you know, not daily directed after specific stories, you know, you being able to be flexible and choose your stories is so important, because you can go after exactly those issues that impact everybody in the state, frankly, but are not the click or, you know, 11 o'clock news, I guess, eyeball grabbers in a certain way, without having that depth that you're able to provide. I mean, if it's just a 30-second story, yeah, dentists say they're going to set up shop and do this, that, and the other to be safer, doesn't really work, but you can go deep, so you can provide that context and tell the story completely.
Yeah, I did that for 13 years at Channel 6. Quite frankly, I was Brian Crandall out in front of the State House or whoever they are for Channel 12 on a given day. I love doing that, but now it's really, let's not get caught up. My father has a phrase that I love using. It's called the tyranny of the urgent. It's right. We're hostage to what's right in front of us. And so particularly in daily newspapers and daily television, the tyranny of the urgent is, what do you have for me for noon? What do you have for me for 5, 6, and 11? And you can't look at the long run. So it's, you know, one of the reasons I love what I'm doing. We want to get stuff up in a timely fashion, but we're not like, okay, if we have to wait a week or a couple of days, it's my call, which is nice.
Yeah. Similarly, this small business petition, you know, with Lieutenant Governor McKee, for listeners who aren't familiar, basically he got 3,700 small businesses to sign on to a petition asking for Governor Raimondo to release at least 10% of the CARES Act money, which would be, hold on a second now.
$125 million.
Yeah, exactly.
That's right. We weren't math majors in college. Where
bingo. And, you know, frankly, I went to the follow-up press conference on Friday, and I was the only reporter there. You know, Channel 6 and Channel 10 had a camera, but I was the only one asking questions. And you could see the lieutenant governor just thinking, wow, you know, this is a disaster, you know, because, again, it's that tyranny of the urgency where you're able to provide a ton of depth on it. And that's, but at the same time, that's not, the new news is not going to lead with that on Channel 10, and certainly not even in the Boston Globe. You know, they weren't covering, you know, no Fitzpatrick or McGowan or Milkovitz on it. So again, you found this area, but the reality is that the governor has to hear those voices that you've put forth in the journal and put forth through the Hummel Report of these businesses, even if the McKee's press conference wasn't well attended, because of your story, you know that the governor knows that the pressure's on.
Well, it's hard to ignore the front page of the journal if she's paying attention, right? Yeah. And the lead story. What baffles me is her communications team. So you have, look, the journal doesn't have as much juice as it used to, but still, the journal leads the way, and it paves the way for a lot of radio and TV, and what are we going to do whether they want to admit it or not? They still have a pretty good staff with, you know, in-depth reporting plus the day-to-day. So what really surprised me was if you saw that on the front page of the journal and you had a press conference that afternoon, wouldn't you come right out and smack me in the face? All right, Hummel, I'm going to take the wind out of your sails. We got a program that we've been working on and we're going to do this. I had to beat it out of her. It didn't come until the question and answer period. And on the third follow-up question, which is why we wanted to get the reporters in the room, on the third follow-up question, she said, and we're going to announce a program next week. It almost makes you wonder, had she been thinking about it, or did that just pop into her head? And she's like, I'll deal with Stephen Pryor on this later. It's just baffling to me. As good political instincts as the governor has, sometimes she's got a blind spot. And I don't think her staff is serving her well by not getting out in front of these things. So
no, I agree. And I'm also shocked that, look, I mean, you've got this dynamic where the lieutenant governor here in Rhode Island and in other states as well, but certainly here in Rhode Island, you know, you think of Bob Healy ran for lieutenant governor on the idea that he would abolish the position. You know, the McKee camp, the Raimondo camp, there's significant differences. They're both fairly centrist, but in different ways. I would say McKee leans more conservative on social issues and
McKee's poison with the unions, the teachers unions, because he's been pushing the charter schools for years. So you talk to any mainline Democrat, and Raimondo's very concerned about that, because not that she has to worry about reelection again, but the whole union influence and owing them, and it goes back to the whole roadworks and the private and the public unions. So if you look at them, she is left of center, and he is definitely anathema to a lot of the union people who see him pushing the charter school agenda.
No doubt. So, you know, it sets up this dynamic where, look, I was thinking months ago during these press conferences that if you went out in the middle of the street, of course, it was a pandemic, so you couldn't. So let's say you phone banked people and you said, hi, I'm going to show you a photo now of somebody, and you show them Brett Smiley. Most people would assume he's the lieutenant governor. You know, that they don't know who these people are. So McKee has really been relegated to the sideline. There's no question about it. And it's interesting to see the governor, though, as you say, not come out with, hey, look, there's a reason for that. And not saying that there is myself, but saying that she comes out and says, look, Commerce Secretary Pryor, whoever else, you know, if she wants to say John Duffy and company, her sort of private sector advisors, whoever it is, have created a plan for small business, and we're going to roll it out. Just as you say, that would not only shut you down potentially for the day, but it would also put McKee's ostracization into context. And instead, it leaves that question of where a Dan York can come out on the radio and beat it home for 3 hours or 4 hours during the furlough here, that McKee, that dynamic is inappropriate, because you're setting up a situation where you've got the number two in command completely out of the loop. And that's all that people by and large are probably hearing. And it puts Raimondo in this context of, hey, you know, she's got this so self-absorbed in her control that's the main reason why she doesn't include McKee in anything, when in reality it's far more complex.
So it goes back to when she elevated the Commerce Secretary to a cabinet-level position. EDC, the Economic Development Corporation, used to be kind of a quasi. So he oversees commerce and DBR. So it's kind of all wrapped into one. So I understand, and McKee, when we did the feature on him back in early June, he said, look, I get it, I'm not part of her administration, but to not at least sit at the table once a week. And then she did the big brush off at the press conference when I asked her about the relationship. Oh, we talk to the general officers regularly. No, she doesn't. The guy who just got banged for DUI, Dan Connors, is the guy who was the liaison. He hasn't had a conversation with her except for Memorial Day to say hi at one of the ceremonies. Hasn't had a real conversation. So what happens when Joe Biden gets elected and she gets chosen for a cabinet position? Not saying it's going to happen, but if it happens and he is the number two guy, he hasn't sat in all those meetings. Now, he's a pretty quick study, but if you haven't, and then he's not really part of that team. So what is that going to do for state government? I just think she would have been smart to take him and give him an assignment and bring him into the fold. But I don't know if it's personal. I mean, you get the vibe. You can hear that. Just, I don't know if there was some event, I don't know, where there was some event where they just did not, you know, they kind of irked each other and then now they've gone their separate ways. But, you know, when you talk to her, him privately, he's got sharper words for her. And when you talk to her, oh, he can give me a call anytime. I know he's been working from home. I mean, that's pretty disrespectful. So.
Yeah, fascinating stuff here. And yeah, it's going to be interesting to see if Joe Biden is elected and she goes to D.C. Treasury, you know, there's who knows where Raimondo could land. It's all very realistic in one sense. And you'd have Governor McKee all of a sudden that, you know, creates a dynamic for 2022 that's a lot different, where you're going to see everybody in the Democratic Party trying to position themselves, where you'd almost have three flanks. You'd have the progressive flank, and then you'd have the sort of semi-progressive standard Democrat flank, and then you'd have the McKee sort of running this almost, frankly, Republican-esque charter school type of conservative Democrat, and furthering that divide in the big tent here in Rhode Island. It would really cement the notion that there are, you know, that the Democratic Party encompasses pretty much everybody but the far right here.
Well, he was going to be running either way. So maybe this, you know, moves it up a little bit. But then he, in effect, becomes the incumbent. So you're right. I mean, so Gourbet is what? Way off to the left. And Magaziner might be a little bit more in the middle. And then he's to the right. And what? And this is wild speculation, but that's what we do, right? Yeah. Look at how – and I look before Link Chafee was elected. If you go back to the early 80s, 1984, the majority of governors have been Republicans. You had Ed DePree for three terms, two-year terms back then, so 6 years. Then you had Bruce Sundland for 4 years. Then you had Link Ammon for two terms and Don Kachiri for two terms before Chafee came in as whatever he was, independent turned Republican turned independent turned Democrat, and then Raimondo. So if you look over the last three decades, the electorate has been kind to people who lean to the right. And I think part of that may be a check and balance. We've got this overwhelmingly Democratic General Assembly. So maybe we need somebody to pump the brakes a little bit. Although, quite frankly, without veto power, it really doesn't matter. I mean, all you really have is the bully pulpit, which John Kachiri found was good at the beginning. And then I think he just kind of got tired and gave up. I mean, so what? You veto the budget and then what? You get steamrolled on an override.
Yeah, exactly. The system, look, you wonder if there's ever going to be a constitutional convention here at some point, or is it just going to remain where we have the Speaker of the House essentially running the show, far outweighing the governor in terms of broad powers? Do you get the sense that we'll ever see that again, where there'll be a significant Ken Block, you know, all these kind of folks that have been calling for it, finally get the momentum, they get a media campaign behind it, whatever it is, do you feel like that's inevitable, or is it more likely that in the next 25, 30 years, things are going to stay as is?
Well, I think I was really surprised it went down as badly as it did the last time they had it up. What was that, 2 or 4 years ago, whatever it was on the ballot? Yeah. The special interest groups came out of nowhere. I mean, they put a lot of money into it. So frankly, whether it happens or not, it has to be voted on. And I think ultimately there has to be an education campaign. The General Assembly can say, fine, let's have it. Let's put it on the ballot. But you never know what's going to – I thought that was something that at the very least – look, constitutional conventions raise major issues. Most of them never make it to the ballot. I mean, there's a pie in the sky. If you remember, you don't remember, but the one from 1985, and we've talked to Pablo Rodriguez a lot about this, is that abortion all of a sudden became a big issue arising out of the Constitutional Convention. And they were very worried about that. So sometimes there's special interests that are like, whoa, we don't want these people to all of a sudden be changing the way we do our business. Right. I don't see an appetite. Look, I mean, clearly nothing's going to happen this year. They can barely get through a General Assembly session. But I wouldn't be surprised in the next 2 or 4 years if it comes up again. You can have one every 10 years. And we haven't had one since 1985. So we're a little bit overdue.
We're going to find out at some point here, probably during this decade, if the push is on. You know, we're seeing it with Providence Plantations being removed from the name and other topics that have been tried in relatively recent times reappearing, well, most likely reappearing on the ballot, or that may have made it through, actually. I can't remember where we're at with that. Welcome to July in Rhode Island politics, you know.
That's a good question. Has it gone through the House? I will tell you, as much as there's been a lot of sound and fury, and personally, I think, okay, that's fine if we want to change it. Yeah. I don't think it's a slam dunk. You hear a lot of people, oh, the momentum is now. Look, 10 years ago when our economy was in the toilet again and unemployment not as high as it is now, but back then, everybody said, you know what? That's going to be the catalyst for regionalization, and we're going to have economy of scale, and you're not going to have 39 cities and towns anymore. And that never happened. And I thought if ever a time was going to happen, it's all about, in that case, it's all about little fiefdoms and power struggles. And, you know, do we want to merge with West Warwick, with Warwick, with East Greenwich and all of that? Now, as much as you hear, yeah, that's okay, there are still a lot of people in Rhode Island who think about, well, it's plantation doesn't really mean plantation. And I get it. I get it. It's a horrible look. But when it comes down to them walking into a voting booth to decide, maybe it may pass overwhelmingly. I'm not convinced it's a slam dunk. And I have no horse in the race, and I know a lot of people feel a lot more strongly about this, and I'm a middle-aged white guy, right? But the Rhode Island electorate is funny that way.
I agree. You know, I personally would very much like to see it removed for a lot of reasons. One, because I hear from people that are just, you know, deeply offended by it. I think back to the when Mayor Lorza struck it out of Providence's official documentation, Councillor Mary Kay Harris gave one of the most powerful speeches that I think I've ever seen. You know what I mean? It was just she was just riffing on this topic, just, you know, completely from the heart, not scripted, not political.
And it had been pent up all those years.
Pent up.
Think about it. She'd been thinking about it for a long time when she delivered that speech. Yep.
And seeing that, it made me think, well, if you could get people to connect to that emotional plea, versus making it seem like a social justice warrior type of plea, I think you'd have more success. It'll be interesting to see the media campaign that if there is any, that goes into this, and we'll find out.
This is the Bartholomew Town Podcast.
Don't miss out on B-Town's live streams and on-location reporting by joining the Bartholomew Town Podcast Facebook group, or head over to btown.stream. Hey, Rhode Island, Bill B here. Whether you're strutting the streets of downtown Providence, on your way to a socially distant cookout, or riding the waves of Matunic. Well, maybe not in the ocean, but wear a mask. It's an easy way to save lives and a great way to crush COVID here in Rhode Island. All right, Lively is back. Lively Experiment. It's now been a month and a half, I think, since more than that.
We started first week of June. So yeah. Six, I think we've done six shows.
Yeah. What was it like for you as someone who... because you're also, similarly to me, furloughed out of WPRO, so to speak, where they're not having outside fill-in hosts. And so what was it like for you during the pandemic to be unable to go on the radio or unable to go on television? You're used to reaching tens of thousands of people per week. Now, all of a sudden, because of the pandemic, you're not. What was that like?
Yeah, my kids got an earful. If you hear me sputtery when I was listening to stuff, we had our kids home for a while, and now they've gone back. But it was frustrating, and I think Lively particularly, if ever there was a time to talk about why is the General Assembly on the sidelines? Should the governor have this much power? What about the nursing homes? All of the issues that we've talked about. Good, solid reporting in this state, but not a lot of commentary. And with all due respect to, you know, newsmakers and 10 News Conference, that's more the meet the press, kind of like talk to the in the old days with Tim Russert, talk to the newsmakers and come in. You know, at Lively's, you know, because you've been part of the show, we get a panel of diverse people to talk about, hey, let's cut to the chase here and do an analysis. And do you like what the governor's doing? Do you not? Should the General Assembly be back? So long story short, it was tremendously frustrating. So we came back when it looked like we weren't going to get back into the building. The president of the station decided, okay, we really need to come back and do it virtually. It's not ideal. You know, there's always technical issues, but the way I look at it is people now are very forgiving because they look at these like Nobel Prize winners in their basement with scratchy internet on CNN, and they get it. They're very forgiving of the technology, even though we'd like to have as good a connection as possible and good audio and lighting. It's the content that they want. And it's been such a nice, you know, it's what we do at Lively. We try to get as diverse a panel as possible and then toss up the ball and see where it goes. The only thing that's missing, and you just can't replicate this, there's nothing like being on set where you see the, where you can, you know, look at somebody out of the corner of your eye and it just, it's not as sharp. And sometimes people are a little, you know, concerned about jumping in and there's stops and starts and whatever. Again, that's just the technical producer in me. I think overall the audience is very pleased that we're back. We get great feedback on it every week.
Yeah, the show, I love the show, and it's look, I wouldn't want it to go on like this forever, but I enjoy watching it in this context. It really puts it in, this is the moment we're in, this is how it, you know, we're in this pandemic, and Lively's adapted. The show continues, and just in spite of the fact that the studio's closed. Now I'm asking you to prognosticate on something that, you know, you probably are not scientifically qualified for. When do you think television studios will open up again? Television, radio, the buildings will open up again and we'll start. I know that Channel 10 and 12, they're doing some version of their operation where you have some people in the building. But right now, you know, WPRO broadcasting from home. I'm doing Zoom for everything. PBS is closed. Do you get a sense that we're going to get back to normalcy with broadcasting here anytime in the near future? Or are you kind of preparing for the long haul being in this mode?
Well, I think a lot of it depends where I thought we were going to come back in studio after Memorial Day, and that changed. And you've got to look where we are in Rhode Island and where we are nationally, right? So the rest of the country's on fire now because they came back too quickly. So I think that's, you know, you hear the governor, don't do the wrong thing. We're all going to be in trouble. You know, you and I get a front row seat for that. It's difficult to say because look at, I think sports is a good mirror on this. I think everybody, the NBA is back in the bubble. College football, they've had some outbreaks. Even on at my university, they had 37 coronavirus cases. So everything's been put on hold. They're going to do conference only in the Big Ten for now. I think you're going to see the SEC and the ACC follow. So the corollary from sports is, this snapshot in time may look a lot different after Labor Day. And my fear, it's my concern because I want to be back on the set, is as management at Rhode Island PBS, clearly they have to worry about liability. They have to worry about the virus and exposing people. My concern is as long as this goes on, they're going to say, hey, we've been doing it this long, let's just keep doing it. And I think you lose something not being in the studio. TV, maybe not as much, but they do have people out in the field, clearly, with those ridiculously long sticks, you know, with whatever. I don't know who came up with that idea, the 10-foot pole.
You're right.
I will tell you, we're going to start, I'm actually just starting this week, getting back to, as much as I've been doing coronavirus stuff, I have a backlog of Hummel Report pieces, fully produced, video, audio, and the journal it's time to get back to work. So I'm going to be interviewing people tomorrow. We'll do it socially. You know, I can certainly do it out in the field. But that's the one thing I've missed. I'm writing stories for the journal. It's just like the old days where I used to just make a couple of phone calls and write and have it come in. The video is a lot more involved, but that's really where the strength of the story is. You know, when you look at video or you hear audio, you can tell when somebody's telling you the truth or not, or frames the issue. So that's kind of a deviation from what you say. I don't know where we're going to be in September, but I think management is going to play it more conservatively than taking a chance.
radio as well? Do you get that sense that, you know, you got to think the guys on WPRO are exhausted? I don't have no idea what they're doing at Publix Radio, but certainly at WPRO, you've got to assume that, I mean, you've got the producers stepping in and filling in now, you know, Weldon and Quinlan or whatever, but at some point you got to think that the dynamic is, you know, you are far, far more than me. You are a staple of that station. One of the reasons I started to listen to that station was for your appearances. So you wonder, when does that become an issue where you've got people who are burnt out because they haven't had a vacation day in 6 months. And then at the same time, you don't have the continuity of those characters like yourself or Bellini filling in, you know, to kind of carry the brand forward.
Yeah, I think so. Here's a couple of things. You know, those 4 hour shifts are not easy. And I used to fill in back in the day. I first started filling in when John DePietro was down at WHJJ. And then at nine, so he used to do 9 to noon. Rush Limbaugh actually came on from noon to three. And then it was Arlene Violet. When 9/11 happened, they expanded because there was just so much, you know, people just wanted to talk, right? So they went. The morning news went to 10 o'clock and DePietro was 10 to 2 and Arlene was 2 to 6. And when I look, when you fill in on a 3 hour shift, you can conceive. I always come with a couple of topics in my back pocket. Trying to sustain 4 hours is really, really difficult. And so that's draining, but also they're getting a week off, whether they want to or not.
Right.
I thought early on, before they started the furloughs, this has got to be, nobody's got a day off. So I have a standing invitation to them for me to fill in. Quite frankly, and this is just my thought, if I were to do that, I'd have to go into the studio. I don't have the same setup everybody else has here. And quite frankly, I don't want to be doing this in my house 3 hours a day. I have my wife occasionally works here. My daughter's been at home. It's unfair to them for me to try to like wall off space to do it. So I've offered to go in and they know that I have a great relationship with the stadium. My feeling is there may be a liability concern.
Yeah.
Having outsiders in the building. Now, practically, if nobody's in there and you just go in the studio and, you know, none of the hosts have been in there touching the equipment, I mean, how could there be any liability? Some lawyer at the, you know, way up here has probably thought nobody but our staff members, because if somebody gets the coronavirus and dies and they pin it on us, you know, we're screwed.
Yeah.
So that's the practical. I have offered to help out. I do think those furlough weeks are helping everybody recharge a little bit. I mean, you got to figure, as much as you want to be on talking, if they give you a week off, you can sleep in a little bit. You can go do other stuff that maybe you weren't able to do. I think the early couple of months before they started the furloughs, I don't know how they did it every day. Nobody got a break at all. Not even to take a 3 day weekend. So,
right. No, it's something else. I think the furloughs end this week. I mean, up the 15th, if I'm not mistaken, this is the end of it. So
you watch, they may continue. If Congress continues that $600 a week, the extra,
yep,
you're going to watch those furloughs continue, I think, because some people are actually making a little bit more. And we've heard this everywhere, particularly part-time people and lower wage. But even some people in media jobs are actually making more with that extra unemployment in addition to what Rhode Island's offering.
Yeah. It's.
Have you heard anything about the third, fourth stimulus, whatever it is?
Nothing yet. I'm certainly curious, and I haven't heard anything about it. You know, it's interesting how under wraps it is. I know that they're talking about a $450 a week bonus if you go back to work. That's one thing. I've heard also they're going to get rid of the $600 and cap it at the highest amount that you've made in the last 2 years or something like that before the unemployment. So there's new ideas that are going around. But
as an incentive for you to go back to work. Hey, just don't sit around, right?
Exactly. Which, you know, look, there's no question that, and I've even advised people as we've talked about on Lively that, you know, if you're a musician, some of the places are starting to have people back in Newport. Some of them are even the Guild in Pawtucket, some places that a lot of people, you know, basically put their living together with. And if you're a musician and you're getting the $600 a week bonus plus whatever percentage you had before, I've said, stay home. You know, I think it's the right thing to do. You know, you have so many, when you have a sea of drunken people in your face, you know, as is often the case in these environments, that is a recipe for getting sick. So there, you know, the incentive there makes sense to me. We can live without live music at a venue for a summer, but you know, if you have two or three people get deathly ill, especially, you know, there's people who are older than me, we'll say, that are out there doing this either full time, or a lot of teachers who do it part time in the summer, retired folks. Come on, they shouldn't be out there in those environments. So I think in some sectors, it does make sense to say, hey, look, you know, even though some people are going to say you should be out there doing it, you know, you're ripping off the system. I mean, come on, that's really what the program's for, is to keep people from spreading the pandemic or spreading the virus.
You know, it's interesting. I go to an Episcopal church, and, you know, the Catholic church was, they really wanted to go. We always say Episcopals, we're Catholics without the guilt. But I'm bummed. You know, Catholics really want to get back to the Episcopal church, and a lot of the mainline Protestant evangelical churches were like, whoa, you know, we got a lot of elderly people. Let's not rush back. So we had a Zoom call with our priest last night. They're not going to be back indoors anytime soon. I just think that I'm sure lawyers have been whispering in the bishop's ear, the Episcopal bishop. So what's interesting is we have a 5:30 Sunday evening service. And it's a little more contemporary. It's a little different than the Catholics, you know, wanting to go at 5 o'clock on Saturday so they can play golf on Sunday. This is more kind of a late Sunday, you know, a lot of guitar music, that type of thing. So what they're going to start with is they're going to start that outside, but no singing. You know, it reminded me when you were talking about, so no singing, you got to bring your own chairs. Everybody's got to be, I mean, so it's like, is that the service you really want to go to? And you can't really talk to anybody afterwards. That's, I mean, after church, it's kind of nice to catch up and everything. It's like, you basically come, you get out of your car, you do the service, and then you get back in your car and go home. So
yeah,
that's really tough. And it's really tough. We have we're no different than a lot of churches. We have a lot of older people in our service, at our services. They have recommended if you're 65 years or older, you probably should not come. And a lot of these people who are widowed or maybe, you know, don't get as much social interactions, they're the ones that really want to come. So it's really, it's really tough all the way around as we're trying to figure out in various sectors how to get back. Look, I don't walk around worried about catching the coronavirus because I take the proper, my wife's probably a little bit more careful. She does a little bit more of the always doing the hand sanitizer and everything. My view is I'm taking all the precautions. Is, you know, I'm relatively fit even though I'm older. I'm not going to live in fear, but this virus is so strange that you read these stories about like 45-year-old people. All of a sudden, it gets them, not even with underlying conditions. So, you know, I heard on the radio this morning some guy going, you know, X number of people die of a heart attack. Well, heart disease is not contagious.
Right.
Right? Exactly. I mean, so I think there is reason to be concerned, because I don't think, as much as they're trying to figure it out, they don't know everything about the virus right now. So it goes back to your larger question, music venues, TV stations, and whatever. If they can continue to do it the way they've been doing it and they don't see a drop off, I don't know why they would rush to get back in the studio. I want to rush to get back in the studio, but I'm, you know, I've got a view about this wide.
Yeah. No, I'm with you there 100%. I miss being in on the TV set at WPRO and performing tremendously. It's taking a toll. Even here, we are in the middle of the summer. We're about to get to the Newport Folk and Jazz Festival weekend. That's our biggest weekend of the year. Revenue-wise, reaching people-wise, we see people from all over the country once a year that come to our events in Newport. And to not have that, it's painful, frankly. But at the same time, there's no way we would do it this year. We'd be out of our minds.
Does your wife get the same earful that my wife and kids got when you just have to, I got to talk to somebody?
Oh, yeah. She's sick of this more than anything else in the world, right? Put it that way.
Wants to get you out of the house.
And what's fascinating is she is at RISD, and they're unsure because she's a painting student at RISD, had just one more semester left, and now it's totally unclear. Last semester, they weren't even able to finish their work. Because everything, you know, to use the machines and the environment where you can spray paint, all this, that, and the other, they got booted out of there. Now it's unclear this coming semester, will these people be able to finish? And you can see a lot of the students are saying, you know what, I'll sit it out. It's not something you can do online. I'm not going to pay the money to, you know, do a visual arts degree when it's socially distant or possibly it's going to be a situation where I have to come back yet another semester to physically complete the work. So there's all these factors that go in. Everybody wants to be back in business, but it's just, you know, what are you going to do?
My son just finished his first year of a 3-year doctorate in physical therapy. Yep. And it's the same deal. They ended in mid-March. There were a lot of his classes, they actually had to give them incomplete because, I mean, with physical therapy, there's a lot of, you know, knowledge about it, but you got to get in there and, you know, whatever they do. And so they're going to catch up with that. Fortunately, he's only in his first year. They've got 2 years to catch up, but they've had to rearrange the whole semester. He was actually supposed to be doing a clinical. He had this sweet rotation down at the beach in North Carolina at a little clinic, and they've canceled that. And what they did was, beginning July 6th, which I think was last week, they started the fall semester. And they're going to PT, not the undergraduates, but PT, beginning of July. They end at the middle of October, around Columbus Wow. Day. And then they're going to do that clinical from Columbus Day to probably just before Christmas. So Yeah. they've got to get creative. And it was funny, I was watching a 60 Minutes piece. North Carolina was one of the first to decide, hey, we're going to bring the students back. We're going to have 2 dorms dedicated in case we need to isolate. They've got all of these protocols. 60 Minutes did a piece where John Dickerson was down in Chapel Hill. He interviews the chancellor and he's talking about all these precautions. And Dickerson, like any good reporter, kind of cuts through it. He says, Chancellor, you know, all of that sounds great, but it sounds like you're one big keg party away from a disaster, yeah. aren't you? And the guy was like, yeah, you know what? I mean, we're planning the best we can. So I think there are an awful lot of unknowns. And I think that's what's unsettling. I think a lot of people, look, we're doing a lot better than other parts of the country, but I think a lot of areas are like, wow, didn't we go through this shutdown? Like, maybe not to the extent Rhode Island did, but didn't we go through this in March and April? And now we're at the point where we're going to have to pull back again. I'm really concerned about the economy for the long run. I really am. I mean, it's a lot of fits and starts. The stock market doesn't seem to be paying attention to what's really going on. But, you know, of course, that's not an indicator of the economy itself.
Yeah, it's going to be looking at 5 years from now. That's a big question mark. You know, you wonder how far in are we going to get in terms of in trouble economically, specifically in Rhode Island? And then how are we going to get out of it? The Fane Tower, I mean, those types of projects, where do they live? All these hotels that are opening up in Newport.
Don't hold your breath on the Fane Tower. Honestly, I don't think it's going to happen.
Yeah, how could it at this point? Everyone's trying to get out of the city at this point. So
exactly. Well, and you see in New York, Bill, I mean, you live down there for a while. My daughter's going back. They've told her she works in Manhattan, lives in Brooklyn. They've said, we're looking to September, October. But if you don't want to come back, if you feel, she and her group of 22, 23-year-olds, they want to go back into the office. They're tired of working from home. But it's interesting. There are a lot of people. I know one person whose daughter was working in Manhattan and moving to Stanford. I think they were buying a house and they were going to keep an apartment in. Well, now their business is moving outside of the city because the real estate's a lot lower. They'll probably never go back to New York.
Yeah,
because either the business moves or if you can work from home. So, I mean, I think, you know, it's not our problem, but I think the New York real estate market's going to be in big, big trouble in the next 6 months to a year.
Absolutely. And where it may be an issue is for trying to buy a home here in Rhode Island, where there's a lot of people who are from Boston and New York transplanting up here so that you could see prices skyrocket. But
you saw that in Charlestown for all those years. When I was down in the Westerly Bureau in the mid-80s, I did a Rhode Islander magazine piece on South County. Back then was still virgin territory. I mean, think of it 35 years ago, and all those people from Long Island and the Hamptons and Connecticut, they were buying up land in South County because it seemed expensive to the Rhode Islanders. But if you're from New York, it was like a bargain. And that's still the case. I'm sure in Charlestown, you know, you see a lot of people from New York. Those were the ones that the governor was stopping on Route 95 as they were coming to their second houses, right?
Absolutely. Military police on the street. So Jim Hummel, ladies and gentlemen, hummelreport.org. You read him in the Providence Journal. You watch him on Rhode Island PBS as the host of A Lively Experiment and the Rhode Island Spotlight, which airs like
occasionally.
Yeah. And of course, hosting on WPRO pretty soon. Hopefully there might be a way to get a Comex box in your house or something like that too. I don't know how they'll do it, but we'll figure it out.
You can see the team of Bartholomew and Hummel Wednesday at the governor's press conference.
Exactly. And more than anything right there, the best. Yeah, and I am so relieved it's down to once a week as well. You know, it's hopefully they take a lot more questions now than previously. I always found that annoying when you'd get one question, you know, each reporter would get one question, and then all of a sudden, once they went through the rotation, it's like, all right, we're out of here. And it's like, well, wait a minute. You know, we're trying to work the information here. It's not about everyone having their turn as much as all the information we need coming out.
I know that ultimately falls on the governor, but, you know, Jennifer Bogdan is now moving on. She's left to take a job at Brown. So I'm not sure whether Josh Block is going to be the guy with the timer, but I agree with you. And, you know, Buddy Cianci, as much as I had difficulties with him over the years, he would wear reporters out. He'd be like, bring it on. He'd answer. And then we'd all look at each other like, you got anything else? And no. And he'd go, okay, now we're done. Yeah. I hate the worst job in the world is being the last question person. Last question.
Yeah.
And Governor Cacciari had a guy, his name was Aaron. Oh, it's his last name is Guckian. Aaron Guckian. Big guy, like 6'8". And I'll never forget standing outside. We were at the Station nightclub fire. And the day after, and Cacciari had just flown in, and we're peppering him with questions. And finally, Aaron goes, last question. And I said, who are you? Yeah. And Kachiri's like, don't beat up on my boy, Aaron. Because Cacciari was never one of those guys who needed a last question guy. But I think Aaron was a little. So I agree with you. Long story short, you have a lot of politicians who are kind of like, okay, last question here. I have found that Raimondo doesn't really, a lot of times they'll say last question. And then remember, she pointed out Tanya Signori once. She was like, with the Echo, hey, did you want to ask a question? Or the other day they said last question and I asked something about testing. She's willing to take the questions. I just think her communications people, maybe they're a little protective of her time, but I mean, she knows what she's doing. She doesn't need protection from her people, right?
Right. Absolutely. Yeah, it'll be interesting to see if Josh Block or Audrey Lucas take a different approach, who will be kind of her, they're already on her comms team, but have each been elevated. So to be determined. Stopwatch, something else.
I'll see you Wednesday.
Looking forward to it. All right. Hey, thanks for coming on B-Town always.
This is the Bartholomew Town Podcast.
Hey, if you'd like to help support the journalism, opinion, analysis, and entertainment that Bartholomew Town has become known for here in the Ocean State, consider a small monthly donation by visiting patreon.com/Bartholomew Town.